This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the space in the metaverse where you, me, the top experts and a big subject get together for 28 minutes. This week, remember trade deals? Getting better ones was going to be one of the big benefits of Brexit. So, nearly 3 years on, what have we negotiated and how have we done? We will now open a new chapter in our national story, striking free trade deals around the world, said then Prime Minister Boris Johnson in December 2020. Today, his successors claim these deals will help level up the UK, cut red tape, provide better investment opportunities and open new digital markets. So, nearly 3 years after leaving the European Union, what deals have we negotiated? How good are they? And what remains to be done? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Before we get into the intricacies of the individual deals we've negotiated or are in the process of negotiating, we wanted to get an idea of broadly how things have changed post-Brexit and how important trade is for our overall economic health. To find out, the Briefing Room's Ben Carter spoke to Darshini David, the BBC's global trade correspondent and author of The Almighty Dollar.
Darshini, how did we trade with the EU before Brexit?
Before Brexit, we never really asked ourselves the question of how we traded with the EU because we were all part of the same club. It was seamless. There were no tariffs charges on goods crossing borders. There were no quotas. Still aren't. But on the other hand, we also had the same regulations, the same standards. We'd signed up to have the same kind of rules and laws in place, which means we didn't have to think about whether or not things were compatible with each other. So it was seamless. It was very much free trade in all its forms.
And how did that change post-Brexit?
What we've got post-Brexit is an agreement that was finally struck on Christmas Eve back in 2020. Feels like a long time ago now. And what was eventually given to the UK and the EU was a deal by which goods could still cross borders without tariffs. There were still no quotas. But it's not fair to say there aren't other hurdles, other barriers in the way, because included in that TCA, it was called, are frankly an understanding that there is an allowance for the UK to diverge when it comes to rules, when it comes to standards, to go its own way. So so-called Brexit freedoms we keep hearing about. But freedom comes at a price, right? So when you talk to exporters, they say that what they're seeing is an increase in that infamous red tape, because you have to make sure that your goods, your services meet the other side's requirements. And when we talk about red tape, that, of course, means additional cost, additional time. So it is a bit more bumpy doing trade with our neighbours than it was.
And what percentage of our global trade came from the European Union before Brexit?
Well, the EU as a bloc, our largest trading partner, 45%, thereabouts, of our imports, exports, done with our closest neighbours. So there is no way you can ignore it. And keeping a fairly free trade agreement with them is incredibly important for that very reason. So when we're talking about trade overall, it's not something we can afford to ignore. And it's not a part of trade that can be easily replaced by boosting trade from elsewhere.
And do we know how that percentage has changed in the last couple of years post-Brexit?
Well, in the few years post-Brexit, of course, we've had all sorts of twists and turns in our drama. We've had that pandemic. We've had the war in Ukraine. And both of those have had incredibly dramatic impacts on the pattern of trade, not just with the EU, but the rest of the world as well. So economists say it's really hard to decipher exactly what's been going on. And it's not just those factors. To add some complications into the mix, the statistics body, the Office for National Statistics, has warned against comparing figures from now with earlier on, because they've changed the way they collect them as well. You know, our matters of trade with the EU has changed, and so that method of collection has changed. So it's really hard to draw a straightforward, this has gone up, this has gone down. But what economists have been doing is poring over the evidence so far, trying to pick out the trends. And what they have found overall is that exports, apart from some variations around the time that the rules were changing, have held up pretty well. But what you've seen happening, according to economists at the London School for Economics, is a change in the composition of those exports. So the variety of exports is smaller, and there's some thought there that perhaps the complexities mean that some smaller exporters in particular are finding it too hard to do business and have simply given up, turned their back on it and say it's not worthwhile. Whereas your bigger exporters, of course, have got those departments that can get their heads around the paperwork, etc. Imports, on the other hand, have actually appeared to have suffered somewhat, which is something that economists are still unpicking. But looming in the background, there is a bigger change to our pattern of trade, which has happened in the post-Brexit era. And that is, we've become less open an economy. What do I mean by that? Well, if you look at trade as a proportion of our income, our GDP, it has changed a bit. It's fallen away. And that's happened here in a way it hasn't happened in other countries. And our trade hasn't bounced back in the way that it has in some of our competitors post-pandemic. And economists are drawing the conclusion increasingly that what we've seen as a result of Brexit is the UK, far from that sort of story of global Britain, has become a more closed economy. It's less reliant on trade. And that matters, because if you're less open, you're less likely to think about being competitive. And that's one of the reasons why, when you look at official estimates from the government's own watchdog, there are some concerns that we are going to become a less productive economy than we would have been. And that's why we talk about an impact on GDP, our income.
And if we look outside the EU, who are our biggest trading partners there?
Actually, our biggest single destination for exports is the US. And that's why a trade deal with America was seen as being the glittering post-Brexit prize. But it's quite clear that that's something that's not on the immediate agenda. If we're talking about where we buy from, it won't surprise you to hear that China is a big source of our imports. But there's other countries as well where we have fairly major trading relationships, for example. I mean, the individual big EU nations do make up a lot of that top 10. But when you get beyond that, you're looking at countries such as Switzerland, for example, and a lot of that's to do with services, part of trade we don't talk about that much. But also, what may be surprising is that some of the countries we've heard a lot about in recent months, the likes of India, for example, the Gulf nations, they make up quite a small proportion of our trade overall. But when we talk about trade and the post-Brexit environment, you could talk about the future and not just what's going on. And those are the growing nations, of course.
Is there a sense of how trade with those countries has changed post-Brexit?
Not much is the short answer. And the picture is very cloudy, because when I talk about the impact on trade in the last few years, you have to look at the pandemic and you have to look at what's happened with the war in Ukraine. Because the pandemic obviously changed not just the level of activities for exporters around the world, but also our buying patterns and our selling patterns as well. And there was thoughts, for example, about, you know, do you source from nearer to home, particularly when you're worried about reliability of supply? Because don't forget, a lot of the goods crossing borders aren't just toys or clothes or finished goods. A lot of it are the bits and pieces that manufacturers need to make, for example, cars or machinery, the less glamorous end of trade, if you will. But that it's still debatable whether or not that has happened. But what we have seen, for example, is a rise in our value of imports, which is wholly reflecting those soaring energy costs. So it's really difficult to pick out an overall changing patterns. But as it stands at the moment, there hasn't been a major shift towards our non-EU partners.
And more broadly, how important is trade to our overall economic health?
It is important. You know, we do well over £1 trillion every year, you know, buying and selling. So we cannot ignore it. You can see, quarter to quarter, how it adds a bit to growth, takes away a bit to growth. And government after government has had ambitions to grow our exports to £1 trillion per year. You may remember George Osborne talking about that. Feels like a long time ago now. Didn't happen. And at the moment, given our outlook for growth and given our current trading patterns, it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon.
Ben Carter talking to Dashini David. The European Union, then, remains our biggest trading partner by far. And just recently, stories have appeared with senior people in government hinting that perhaps we might need to forge a closer relationship with the EU. Peter Foster is the public policy editor of the Financial Times. Peter Foster, we heard from Dashini David that we're now in what's called the EU-UK Trade and Cooperation Agreement. Now, what does that involve?
Well, that agreement is a basic Canada-style agreement. So we're outside the EU customs union and we're outside the EU single market. And in order to move goods into the EU, we have to cross those barriers, tariff barriers, but also regulatory barriers. So the deal is a zero tariff, zero quota deal. So any good that can demonstrate it's sufficiently made in the UK can go in zero tariff. But when you talk to traders, more of the headache, particularly if you're in something like food or moving an organic product or moving a complex product, is filling in all those bits of paperwork that make sure that your good conforms to the regulatory rules of the European Union. Because when we left the EU, we really decided to try and cut the apron strings, to take no dictation from European court, to follow no European rules. So even though we actually do follow lots of, or mirror lots of European rules still, the presumption is that we don't. So the burden of proof is on us and our traders, and that creates barriers to trade.
Now, a lot of people were struck last weekend when there was a story about some members of the government saying they wanted to improve our trading relationship with the EU. What did you take that to mean?
Well, what they said was they wanted a Swiss-style agreement. Now, that means paying into the EU budget, accepting a measure of free movement and dynamically aligning with EU rules, so following EU rules immediately they come out. Now, I don't think that's what they meant. What they meant was incrementally moving our trade closer to the EU. Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, saying he wants to remove the barriers to trade. The difficulty is, if you plug, I don't want free movement, I don't want to follow anything to do with EU law, and I won't pay into the EU coffers, then the EU computer spits out very little.
In other words, the ambition which underlies that can't easily be realised.
No, the EU, all the way through this process, has said that there is a balance of rights and obligations. Now, when we negotiated the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, the British government decided it wanted to be fully autonomous. It wanted to escape all of the regulatory orbit of the European Union, and that's why we ended up with a pretty low ambition basic deal. If you want to increase the access, then your obligations to the European Union increase proportionately. And so when you hear people say the Brits want to have their cake and eat it, what they're really saying is we want access, but we don't want the obligations. And the European Union has so far demonstrated itself pretty reluctant to allow us to cherry pick our way into its single market.
Now, in many ways, Peter, that feels fairly obvious. So once again, you do wonder what the people who were creating that story in government were trying to do.
I think what they were trying to do was to say, look, we recognise that the Trade and Cooperation Agreement has caused barriers to trade, has had negative effects, and we want to make it better. So they're signalling that after the Liz Truss debacle, perhaps that they're sensible and they want to make things better. Of course, it had the secondary effect of stirring up a hornet's nest among the Brexiteers, who still cling to this idea that in order for us to prosper outside the European Union, we need a really clean, hard break from Brussels, and we need to go into deregulatory divergence. We need to have separate laws so we can be nimbler and quicker. And so, in effect, in trying to soothe the markets, what they also did was advertise the divisions in the Conservative Party that remain deep and abiding over this question of how to prosecute Brexit.
Does it amount to anything more then than a suggestion that the government will seek not to diverge wherever possible from EU standards? Is that essentially what they're saying, if in return the EU will be nicer to us?
I think it's actually the opposite. If you listen to Jeremy Hunt in his budget statement, he said we want to use our Brexit freedoms to announce changes to EU regulations in growth industries like digital tech, life sciences. And he's appointed Sir Patrick Vallance, remember him from the COVID era, to do a review of where we can diverge. The difficulty with that is that if you're saying you want to diverge, then it gets much harder to simultaneously say we want to have closer relations with the EU, because in order to have a closer relationship on food standards, etc., you need to converge, not diverge. So the two things are just working against each other.
Do you think this has got something to do with the problem the government has with economic growth, that it wants to signal that it will do whatever it takes to get economic growth, which might include closer relationships with the EU, but actually doesn't necessarily have the mechanisms to achieve it?
I think the government's in a bind. On the one hand, it's wedded to this idea that Britain, go it alone, Britain can prosper by deregulating outside the EU, whilst at the same time recognising that we do 50% of our trade with the European Union and erecting a host of non-tariff and tariff barriers to trade with our largest market on our doorstep is damaging our growth prospects. And that's just a fundamental, it's the bind of Brexit.
Peter Foster suggesting that there might be less to this than meets the eye. But now let's broaden out beyond the EU. What about the other deals we've negotiated or are negotiating? How beneficial are they or might they be? Joining me in the briefing room are Sam Lowe, partner at Flint Global, a business advisory service where he runs the trade and market access practice, and David Hennig, director of the UK Trade Policy Project. David Hennig, if I can start by asking you, what's happened to the existing trade deals that we had when we were in the EU?
By and large, most of the existing EU trade deals to which the UK was a party, we have made replicas of them, more or less the same. There are a few tweaks to them. There are a handful of exceptions to that, those being Algeria, Bosnia, Montenegro. But by and large, the major ones, the likes of South Korea, for example, Canada, Mexico, they were rolled over. And we're starting to look at upgrading some of those. But more or less, the situation is as it was before.
Now, Sam, last week there was a Conservative Party claim circulating on social media saying we've secured new free trade deals with over 70 countries since 2016. That's over £800 billion worth of new global trade. Now, as far as you can tell, how much of this is new and how much of it is just replica deals, essentially?
The bulk of that figure is actually the UK's trade agreement with the European Union. Then on top of that, most of those agreements are the ones that we've replicated following our exit from the European Union, as has been described by David. But then we do have a couple of new ones that we've negotiated that aren't yet in force, but should come into effect in the next year or so. So that's with New Zealand and with Australia.
David, let's talk about the Australia deal, because it's got some attention recently. How was that deal negotiated? Just remind us, and what was in it?
Pretty quickly after we left, full negotiations took place and agreement was first reached with Australia and then with New Zealand. Now, not everyone felt entirely happy with the outcome of it, but what we got with Australia and with New Zealand was an agreement that substantively we would allow pretty much all of their agricultural produce in with a few years a transitionary period. And in return, we got slightly improved access to their procurement markets and their services markets. And the argument would be, did the UK get enough from Australia in return, for example, for all the agricultural access we gave them? And what would be the risks of this deal and indeed the opportunities?
Now, Sam, George Eustace, who was essentially in charge of agriculture, also environment, at the time that the deal was negotiated, said last week that whatever he'd said before, now he was telling you the Australia deal, and I quote, is not actually a very good deal. Now, is he right about that?
So this is one of those issues where it's a question of perspective. If you are a UK farmer and you are looking at these agreements and saying the UK over a number of years is going to eventually allow all Australian beef to enter the UK tariff-free, I can understand why you might have some concerns about that, because you're worried about the increased competition from Australian imports. But at the same time, you've also lost your market access to the EU, or it's been reduced, and you're going to have to deal with a new subsidy regime at home. However, I think you do have to take a step back when assessing trade agreements. And whilst you can acknowledge that there might be a single constituency that has reason for concern, you also then have to look at it from a different perspective. So, for example, the consumer perspective on this is that we will have greater access to Australian food products. they will be able to enter the UK more cheaply, leading to more competition, more choice. You also have to look at the other elements of the agreement. For example, on youth mobility, the UK and Australia have agreed that now a young person is considered as up to 35 rather than up to 30, and you can go to each other's countries to work for 3 years. And also in the context of Australia, you no longer have to do some sort of hard labour on a farm if you want to exchange your visa beyond one. My view here is that actually, the agreement is fine, but that doesn't mean I don't sort of have some sympathy for the sectors that maybe lose out.
Now, Sam, that was Australia. There was also quite a big deal made about the trade deal with Japan. Was that a good deal?
The Japan agreement was effectively a rollover agreement, but we bolted on some extra things, particularly in the space of digital services, where the UK and Japan made explicit commitments not to, for example, apply tariffs to cross-border data flows or require firms to store their data locally as a condition of market access. I would say that on the agricultural space, and we always come back here, the UK actually got a bit less than what it had whilst it was in the EU, because the Japanese quibbled slightly and the UK hopes to readdress that in the CPTPP, the Comprehensive Progressive and Trans-Pacific Partnership accession negotiations coming up. But for the most part, Japan, yes, I think it's a good deal. And it's largely the same as the one we had before.
David, the other big one, which was talked about an awful lot, was India. Now, where are we now with that one?
Well, the big picture is that the low-hanging fruit, if you like, the easier deals have been done. Australia and New Zealand, notwithstanding the issues over agriculture, were always going to be easier. India, which has been held up for so many years as a country with which we should do more business, has always been a difficult market. It's a difficult market for UK business to operate there, and it's a difficult market for anyone to negotiate trade deals with, which is why they don't have very many of them. And one issue you've got is the sheer disparity in market conditions. It's very hard for UK businesses to do business in India, much easier for Indian businesses to do business in the UK. Now, there have been a lot talked about in terms of visas for this deal. But in fact, the UK and India have been talking about visas separately to this deal and came up with an agreement last year on it. So it's not primarily about visas. Primarily, this deal is going to be about whether the UK can secure meaningful improvements to access in India, what the Indians are looking for in terms of reduced tariffs into the UK, but also the ability of people working for an Indian company to move to the UK and carry on working, which is something the Home Office has never been a big fan of. Negotiations are ongoing. The Indians, as it is understood, have made a not wholly generous offer to the UK in terms of market access. This means that, for example, there would still be tariffs on UK cars going to India, but maybe lower than they are at the moment. We'd expect tariffs to be lowered on Scotch whisky, but perhaps not eliminated. And I think it's in the hands of the UK government now to decide whether they want to accept a deal that will perhaps be not great, but will hold out the hopes of building something better in the future, or whether to hold out now and try to get something better. And that's not an easy decision.
I'd just like to emphasise why the India agreement is potentially so important, though, which is, as David said, it is quite a closed market, and it also has the potential to be one of the biggest markets in the world ever, if you just look at population size. So there is this feeling that if you can get first mover advantage, so even if you don't quite get everything you want, but you get slightly better access than everyone else, better access than the Americans, better access than the European Union, that the relationships you build as a result could put you in a very good place moving forward. And these are the sorts of dilemmas the government face, because actually, if you move quickly, you could get some of that. If you hold back and try and get a bit more, you might never get the agreement at all.
Sam, have we done anything with China?
No. And as far as I'm aware, there are no intentions to. In terms of substantive trade agreements, there's no desire there. And interestingly, there was never any talk about picking up the EU negotiations with China for an investment agreement.
And David, the United States?
Well, this is quite the cursed trade deal, because the UK and the US really had hoped to do a trade deal while Trump was still president. But because Brexit dragged on, it meant that they couldn't really start talks in time, and then Trump was coming to the end of his time. And what's happened since then is that President Biden has shown absolutely no interest in new free trade agreements. And it should be said that although trade agreements can give you some benefits, they also have costs, as we've discussed already, potentially with regard to farmers, and they may not focus on many parts of the economy, such as services. So the US has decided, under President Biden, but I think it will carry on going forward, that free trade agreements really don't give you enough to be worthwhile. So what we're doing with the US, for example, is we're deepening cooperation in a number of areas. We're having discussions about regulatory issues. We're having discussions around, for example, small and medium enterprises. But we're unlikely to do a trade deal. Will there be a slight loss to that? Perhaps. But there is an argument that says we perhaps focus too much on free trade agreements and not enough on all the other things that governments can do to help facilitate trade. And with the US, that's going to be put to the test, because that's what we're going to have to do, because the US aren't very interested in doing it the free trade agreement way.
And David, can you give us a brief tour d'horizon of the rest of the globe?
In terms of other markets, we're starting to look at talks with the Gulf, but another tricky set of countries to do deals with. We're talking with Canada and Mexico and Israel to enhance deals we already have. I think we should be talking soon with South Korea, if I understand that rollover soon. And I would imagine there may be one or two other priorities. For example, we still seem to have a fairly thin agreement with Turkey. That's an obvious, fairly close market that we could do more with. And we're trying to do more with Switzerland as well. So there's quite a work program there, but it's perhaps slightly less eye-catching. It gets a bit more tricky, and we certainly won't get the pace of announcements that we had once upon a time when Liz Truss was Trade Secretary and we were doing all of these rollovers.
Could I just add a couple of markets that seem to be missing from the UK's agenda that slightly intrigue me? So one is the Mercosur bloc. So this is Brazil, Argentina and some others in South America. And this is, again, would be quite a big deal. Brazil is a big country, and the EU has negotiated agreement it's going to struggle to ratify with them. And we just don't discuss that in the UK, which I find slightly odd. There's also Indonesia. So Indonesia has a trade agreement with Switzerland, Norway, and others. It has trade agreements with countries in Europe. And we're starting to tentatively think about it, but we haven't quite got there. And again, potential to be a huge market going forward.
If we look at it overall, does being out of the EU make the UK somehow more nimble in negotiating better individual deals? Or does it make things trickier because we lack the clout of a European bloc approach?
I think it makes negotiating new free trade agreements easier in that the UK is more able to concede. So the UK can say, yes, we'll just give you that. And you only have to really worry about one political constituency, which is your own. The issue the European Union has, and it has been very successful on trade agreements, but where it struggles is when it comes to saying yes to other countries in order to, say, get a trade agreement over the line and then actually getting it ratified at home. So I mentioned Brazil earlier. The EU has this trade agreement ready to go. I'm not sure it will ever be able to actually bring it into force.
And that's because there will often be a constituency somewhere in the EU which doesn't like it.
27 countries. Where the difference is in the EU's favour is the EU is more able to say no and still get a trade agreement. We saw, so it's negotiated a trade agreement with New Zealand, and it has given New Zealand far less access to its market than the UK did in respect of agriculture.
And David, how do you calculate the balance of advantage?
I calculate it in neither direction, actually, that I think that clearly we have less heft than the EU, but we also have fewer interests necessarily to take account of. And so I think it comes down to, are we clear enough what our own interests are in doing the free trade agreements? And are we able to pursue that? And I think actually the weakness has been that we still lack a really good understanding of what our interests are in these free trade agreements, in particular, because we're mostly a services exporter, a world-leading services exporter, and free trade agreements focus more on goods than they do services. So I think we're still in early days, and I think that we may want to be looking wider at what we can do with trade now that the easy trade deals are done.
I'm going to summarise you both here in this sense by saying that on the whole question of trade deals, etc., there is no big gain or big loss to be had either way.
So we don't like to admit this because obviously we work in this space and we want people to pay us for our advice and to be really interested in what we're talking about. But I think anyone who works on trade policy and is being honest would say that the gains derived from free trade agreements in particular are quite marginal. And I'm still in favour of them. I think marginal gains can add up over time and can be incredibly positive cumulatively. But on an individual basis, you're not going to be throwing out big numbers either positively or negatively on an aggregate basis.
Sam Lowe there with David Hennig. My thanks to them and to Darshini David and Peter Foster. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Daniel Gordon. The editor was Simon Watts. The programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds, like the one on the chances of a nuclear strike in Ukraine, the one on how to get growth in the UK economy, and why there's so much you-know-what in our rivers.
Are you confused about why your mortgage rate is going up? Unsure of what causes inflation or befuddled over what GDP stands for? I've got the perfect podcast for you. I'm Tim Harford, and in my new Radio 4 podcast, Understand the Economy, I'm taking you back to basics. I'm going to explain all the complex financial terms you're hearing in the news as clearly as I can. Inflation, interest rates, growth, bonds, banks, I'll explain it all. Search for Understand the Economy, available now on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.